Welcome to a new episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock and Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets, and digital money, and helps you understand how digital assets and money will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas Gross, and today I'm joined again by our guest host Jonathan Noll from Etonic. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Jonas. Great to be back for another episode of our Digital Money interview series.
Yeah, my pleasure. And today we are speaking with a very, very impressive person, which I'm really looking forward to the discussion. The person is José Fernández da Ponte. He is President and Chief Growth Officer at the Stellar Development Foundation, so the entity that is also behind the Stellar protocol that I guess most of the listeners will know for sure, and also former head of blockchain and the digital currency business unit at PayPal.
Yeah, I would say José is one of the most thoughtful voices in digital money and brings in, from my perspective, a super unique point of view because he's right in the middle of Web3 right now, right? Leading the charge at the Stellar Foundation. But at the same time, he's worked at BBVA, he's worked at PayPal. At PayPal really helped shape the whole global crypto and digital asset strategy there. And so there's this really unique perspective of somebody who understands, is very, very deep in the Web3 side, but understands the Web2 side as well. So super happy to have you here. José, welcome to the show.
Hello, Jonas and Jonathan. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So again, as I was saying, what I think is really interesting here is this isn't going to be a typical crypto native discussion on blockchain, but we're talking more on, you know, what needs to be done to rebuild the financial infrastructure kind of from first principles. And obviously, José, you've got a great background for that. And in addition, Stellar seems to be at the center of some really interesting trends happening right now, right? Obviously, stablecoins as more of a payment infrastructure versus just trading. Real-world assets is getting bigger and bigger every day. Institutions, which I think we'll talk a lot about in a little bit, are actually really deploying regulated financial products on blockchains and particularly in public blockchains, which is really an interesting move. And of course, we have to talk about AI. We're incumbent to do that. That's going to be an agentic commerce, agentic payments is obviously a big influence on everything we do today. And hopefully we'll have time to talk about privacy and compliance because that's something near and dear to my heart and Jonas's heart as well. So let's get right into it.
Yeah, and let's dig into basically how this all started, José. So probably not like the childhood, but at least how your personal journey started. So you've worked across banking, payments, fintech, digital assets and money for a long time now, including, as Jonas has said, places like BBVA and also PayPal. Like, what did originally pull you into, you know, the topic of digital assets, money, and also stablecoins ultimately?
So I've been privileged and lucky to be involved in payments and fintech for the last 20 years or so. And I have seen the evolution of the industry in a number of regions. I grew up in Europe. I've done a ton of work in Latin America and Africa and Southeast Asia. And I've been living in the US for the last 15 years. So that allowed me to have kind of a first row seat on how payments and financial infrastructure have been evolving over the years. And I started to tinker on the blockchain side during my BBVA days. So this was probably 2015, 2016, starting to move money between bank accounts using layer ones available at the moment. And it was, I don't think it was an Eureka thing, but it was one of those of, hey, there is something here. I'm not a crypto ideologist by any means. I come at the crypto world from a lens of someone who works in payments. I'm much more of a payments person than anything else. But when I started to go down the rabbit hole of blockchain, say, well, this is the first time that I've seen in my career a technology that can fundamentally reshape financial rails. So if you look at the way that we still conduct most of our transactions, we are building or we're still executing on rails that were built 50 years ago. So if you think of why wire transfers are called wire transfers, is because they were built to run on telegram wires. So that's 130-year-old concept, which was fantastic. Credit cards, the ACH, all those are basically 50-year-old technology, which we have kept improving on. But if you look at fintech, a lot of what we did in terms of innovation as an industry in fintech was mostly about better UX interfaces, better user experience, and better fraud models for card-not-present transactions. The rest of it, the underlying infra, is still going through the same nostro vostro corresponding bank settings. And what I saw in blockchains was one way to increase the speed and transaction and finality but also do it on open source permissionless technology. I'm a big, big fan of open source technology. I always get concerned about infrastructure capture. Jonathan, you and I have talked a lot about Web 2 and some of the things that could have gone better in Web 2. And the capture by some institutions of most of the traffic is one of the issues that we have seen. So I look at blockchains as Linux for payments. And that's one of the reasons that I came to Stellar. I came to the foundation last year because I very much felt that it was a moment in which I wanted to get smarter on the infrastructure side. I did a ton of work on the application layer on the PayPal days, but I really wanted to get smarter on the infrastructure. And what does it take to create a vibrant ecosystem, both for developers and for institutions? So that's kind of a long, winding way through banking and PayPal into the foundation and the Web3 side. And extremely excited. I don't think there's been a more exciting moment for the industry than Web3.
Yeah, and I think this also explains very well then why you decided to leave the traditional payment side of things, right, and go more to the infrastructure side, but more on the permissionless space with Stellar. But we talk about Stellar then later on. I mean, you framed this very positively. We also did see some kind of a tipping point on stablecoins as well, just in the recent years. So stablecoins have, and you have said this repeatedly, are more and more becoming core infrastructure now. So historically, this was, let's say, kind of some kind of a crypto use case, right? So you needed to park your liquidity somewhere, so you went into stablecoins, but now we do see a lot of use case where also Stellar shapes them regarding remittances, payroll, treasury lending, cross-border commerce, whatsoever. Like, what do you think has basically changed and driven, let's say, such a stablecoin momentum? So was this just about, you know, let's say, regulatory clarity, or, you know, why now? You've been in the space for 10 years now, so why are stablecoins now going through the roof? Or are they?
I think that the regulatory clarity is definitely one of the things that happened. I was in on the PayPal side, and many folks from the Stellar Foundation very involved on the process that led to the Genius Act in the US. And I think that especially in terms of institutional adoption, you can see a before and an after in terms of institutional interest on the passing of the Genius Act in the US. I think that it became a moment in which institutions said, okay, we're getting the memo, we're getting the message. This is okay, this is an instrument that is going to be around and we should be exploring it. I think that this is this very weird moment, the moment that we're recording this in late May of 26, where traditional crypto markets are doing one of their topsy-turvy volatility journeys. But all the conversations that I am having with institutions who are thinking about stable coins and real asset tokenization, they couldn't care less about what the price of Bitcoin is doing in a certain moment. You know, we're seeing a decoupling from traditional crypto markets and the volatility associated to them with institutional interest on the stablecoin and RWA side. So it is definitely, part of that is regulation. I think that you have Genius, you have MiCA in Europe, you have some of the regulatory structures that have happened in places like the Gulf countries and Singapore and some others. There's a ton of interest in places like Brazil, where the central bank has been very, very active in the exploration of both stable coins and CBDCs. I just came from Ghana a few weeks ago and from spending time with central bankers in the African continent. There is an incredible amount of interest on stable coins. So the regulatory piece is one of them. The crypto native use cases is still very relevant. And if you look at volume, sometimes as an industry, the crypto industry likes to compare apples to oranges. We all have seen there are about $300 billion in assets under management on the stablecoin side, but we always hear volumes on trillions in circulation and comparing that to the total amount on transaction with Visa and MasterCard. That is not a fair comparison because a lot of the volume that you see on stablecoins is still crypto trading and money moving from one exchange to another exchange, which is a very valid use case, but it's less payments in the sense that you and I would think about it. But you see the early stages of real payment use cases. If you look at, there are probably about $400 billion in real payment volume that is happening on stablecoins these days. A lot of that is business to business. Increasingly, the consumer to business piece that you see, stablecoin funded card instruments, which is a very, very interesting turn of events. If you were to tell me 3 years ago, I would not think that Revolut would be issuing a credit card that is funded by stablecoin. So that combination, I think that's where you start to get into the places that either you have a corporate user for whom it's a very rational conversation to increase settlement time, increase availability, reduce working capital, or a consumer who does not want to deal with form factors and care a lot about non-custodial wallets, they want to use a form factor that they can use in their everyday expense. So that combination of the maturing of the technology, the regulation, and the early stages of real payments activity, I think that that's what is driving a ton of the interest that you see these days.
Yeah, I think that that makes a ton of sense. And one phrase that you use and kind of a mental model, if you will, and I love it. You talk about Lego bricks, right? And each Lego brick building on the last. Could you kind of double click on that for our listeners a little bit and talk about how you, what you mean by that and what that looks like in practice with things like USDC on Stellar or, you know, or on and off ramps or tokenized assets, whatever examples you want to use, but just talk a little bit about that, that concept. I like that.
Yeah. So if you build from first principles in both economics and computer science, composability and recursion are very, very important forces when you're building something that needs to scale, right? So composability is this idea of the Lego bricks, that things that you can build on top of each other. And recursion is that idea of if you want to solve a very, very thorny problem, just try to make the smaller instance of the problem and then you build from there. I think it's going to be very difficult to upgrade financial infrastructure with one huge behemoth initiative to replatform the whole financial system worldwide. I don't think that's how change happens. I believe that is happening in this way, in which you have a full stack where you have the blockchains themselves and the primitives that lead to consensus, openness, privacy, which I know we'll talk about, and security. And many of those things need to happen at the infrastructure layer. Then you have the protocols themselves. Then you have the applications. Then you have the UX. And different people are going to be building in different aspects. At the Stellar Foundation, we have the benefit that we play on the infrastructure side, and we get to play with all the shiny toys and the elliptic curves and the quantum resistance and all of that. Yeah, I would argue that if you are a fintech or you are a PSP or you are a bank, more likely than not, you're going to play in the application and UX stage. And that's probably the right place for those folks to build. And you need to build on top of what has existed, the layers that exist under you. That's why the moment that you have a set of high throughput, secure, battle-tested blockchains, then you can start to build a stablecoin protocol on top of it. And then you need to combine it with the traditional custodians that have happened there, because remember that in the end, the successful model for stablecoins have been fiat-backed stablecoins. That requires a smart contract that will mint and burn tokens, but also and custodians who can store those tokens and exchanges that will provide distribution, but also requires good old-fashioned custodians for the reserves of the stablecoins. So the reserves, the treasuries, the repos, they are all going to be sitting in large traditional finance institutions. So that idea that you combine the building blocks on TradFi with the building blocks of the new technology and you continue to build on top of it, I think that's what it accelerates growth. It is also one of the places where, as an industry, we need to remain very vigilant for vulnerabilities in the system. I think that part of what you see in the recent exploits on the DeFi ecosystem is a situation in which each of the individual parts are saying, hey, look, the protocol, my piece of the protocol did exactly what it was supposed to do, and yet an attack happened. So I think that as we continue to do this composability and connect different pieces, we need to make sure that those pieces are hardened themselves, because if not, you're just building supply chain vulnerabilities into the system. I think that's a lesson that has been learned in the early part of the year. I've been actually very impressed on how the industry has reacted to that. But also the one of the increased risk vectors these days for blockchains and non-blockchains is that the speed of attacks in an AI-driven environment and the exploitation of vulnerabilities, it has become much, much faster. So composability is a positive force moving forward. We need to make sure that we get extremely strict on audits and scrutiny and making sure that we detect any vulnerability that might appear.
Yeah, great points. Still much to be done, but so much has been done already. So let's talk about, so I think a good segue into tokenization, more specifically, actually the Stellar ecosystem in particular. I have been in the space since 2017. And since then, we've been talking about everything that can be tokenized, will be tokenized, and the institutions are coming. And there are multiple times where I thought, okay, here now it's coming. Now it's really happening. I have it. My personal feeling is it feels different this time. It feels like it really is happening, but I have said that before, to be honest. So what's your feeling, Jose? Is it different this time? Do you think the institutions really are coming, and why now? I mean, you've touched on some of that, but we can start getting into some of the work that Stellar's doing in this space.
Yeah, I think that the institutions are coming. If you look at the early pioneers here, so Franklin Templeton has been building in the space for many years. The first money market fund that was tokenized was Franklin Templeton's Benji, was tokenized on Stellar 5 years ago. We recently celebrated the fifth anniversary. Institutions like MoneyGram, where we are also very active, have also been building the space for about 5 years. PayPal, the kernel of the seeds of the PayPal work on digital assets is, I think that the first product was launched in late 2020. So they have been a bunch of institutions that have been blazing a path into digital assets. But what you have these days is just incredible. If I just look at the company we keep on the Stellar side and the institutions that have chosen to deploy on us, it is indeed Franklin Templeton and PayPal and MoneyGram. Recently, you add Societe Generale and Amundi and WisdomTree and Janus Fenderson, you name it, DTCC we just announced. So you really see many of the regional institutions in APAC and others, and especially market infrastructure partners. So I do think that institutions are coming. As we were saying earlier, no institution that I talk to is concerned by the least for what is the state of crypto markets on any given day. They're the ones who are building and powering through. And it's very, very super interesting because many of the conversations that I'm having are moving to the next stage of sophistication. So the conversations on a stablecoin used to be about feasibility and regulation. I think that we are way past that. It's moving now toward use cases and distribution. And interestingly, it's starting to be about non-USD denominated stable coins. Still, most of the volume that you see on stable coins is denominated in USD. In my view, that is an artifact of the use case. It is an artifact that the predominant use case for stable coins today are crypto markets that are denominated in USD. But if you want stable coins to trickle down into everyday activity, it will need to happen in local currencies. So you see what is going on in Europe with the emergence of euro-backed stable coins. We had EuroC by Circle, but all of a sudden we have a EuroCB by SocGen. You have, obviously, you have Monidium. You have AllUnity getting into the market. And the volume is getting into places that is still small compared to USD, but it's bigger than a bread box. I think that the monthly volume on euro-denominated stable coin is about 700 million now, which, again, is still relatively small, but is orders of magnitude more than it was a year ago. And on the RWA, the question has moved from last year, people thinking, hey, how feasibility? So can I really tokenize a money market fund? Can I tokenize a credit fund? Largely, the consensus now is yes, you can do it. There are a number of infrastructure providers and chains that will support it. The discussions that I'm having with asset managers these days have moved very quickly to distribution. So yes, I can tokenize a money market fund. But the moment that this is that I have it tokenized, how do I sell it? So does that cannibalize my existing buyer base? It opens up new use cases. Can it be used as collateral for blockchain or any other aspects? And that moves the conversation from the asset issuer to the wirehouses, to the broker dealers and the wealth managers and the family offices. So everything that I'm seeing is a big push from understanding the having more regulatory clarity, understanding the technical feasibility, and not saying, okay, what does this mean for my business? How do I get this in hands of users? And I don't see, you saw the recent news of Qvalis in Europe that has now what, 35 banks joining there. You have the initiative on Faro led by Santander and a number of other systemic banks. You see, if you were to tell me 9 months ago that we would be looking at a JP Morgan Chase Ethereum ETF, I would say, no, you have to be kidding. So definitely institutional push is felt at the systemic level, but also at the regional level. We see regional institutions like Chenanga in Malaysia and many others who are decidedly jumping into the space with both feet.
Great insights. And I think it's really interesting as I reflect on what you're saying, how many firms are deploying on Stellar that are not crypto native startups, right? that in of itself is a completely new thinking, as it were. So for these institutions that you mentioned, like the PayPals, the MoneyGrams, the U.S. Bank, you did some interesting things with, I know, recently. What are these institutions looking for in a blockchain? And how do they go through kind of deciding who they should deploy on? Because they have lots of options.
I think they look at a number of things. So they will look at the first level. Initially, they tend to look at transaction speed, throughput, and cost per transaction, which is a very basic layer. They also look at liquidity. I don't think there is a natural monopoly for blockchains, but also I don't think there are going to be 300 blockchains that matter on the institutional side. I think there's a minimum critical mass that you need to have an ecosystem that can sustain economic activity. But then very quickly, the conversation goes toward institutional grade. And what I mean by institutional grade is compliance, uptime, risk management, the things that traditional financial institutions will always care about. Would maybe if you operate on the DeFi environment, there is a little bit more, it's a higher risk appetite and you can get away with a looser environment. But if you're going to be deploying, or if you're looking at systemic institutions who are thinking about deploying on a blockchain, they are going to care a lot about, can I implement my risk procedures and my risk control framework on this blockchain? Meaning, how natively do I have compliance features like ability to freeze assets, ability to claw back? How can I implement my KYC requirements on this blockchain? How regulatory friendly the environment is? Openness is an incredibly important one. I think that we are going to see the crypto ecosystem emerging from a little bit of the libertarian side of the house, which is still very much alive and well kicking. You saw a little bit of a pendulum swing to the other side in terms of permission chains. And I think that we remember R3 and the Corda blockchain a few years back, and still there was much more about it. We're going to interact into be in between financial institutions. I care less about decentralization because I know the 9-10 institutions that I'm going to interact with. So I'm going to build something that looks like a blockchain, but basically it's a distributed database. And I don't say that with any slight. There are very good use cases for distributed databases. And then you're converging to the scenario that we have today, in which I believe that you have a small number of open source, permissionless, public blockchains, and Stellar is one of those, where anyone can build, that they are verifiable, that they are battle tested. You put it in, not to speak too much about us, but you put it in our context, we've been around for 11 years with 99.99% uptime, which means that basically the Stellar network has been down for 10 hours in the last 11 years. So when you're going to do transaction volumes in the billions or trillions or quadrillions that will get there, you need the very minimum, that's the type of uptime that you need. But also you are seeing now the emergence of, if you want, I don't know what's the right name for this, corporate chains maybe. So chains that are sponsored by one specific actor. So you have Tempo, which is sponsored by Stripe. You have Arc coming from Circle. You have Canton, which is coming from a bunch of traditional finance players. And I think that first, clients are sovereign and they will decide where they want to interact. But I believe that the role of open source and permissionless chains have never been as important as it is today. I am a Web2 veteran. I've seen infrastructure capture. I am very committed to not seeing infrastructure capture again. I'm totally fine with corporate sponsored chains existing as long as they are not the only option. My analogy is always email. I'm totally fine with people using corporate providers of email as long as I don't need to sign up with one of them to interact. They can use the fact that they are open source email clients like Thunderbird and from Mozilla or Proton or others. And at the extreme, that if I wanted to build my own client, I can go to SMTP and build my own email client. I think that's something that is very, very important. I don't want to live again in a world in which a number of providers and institutions have control of the substrate. And that's not what we came here to build. So that is what I am seeing in terms of, and again, and I don't think that there's going to be one blockchain to rule them all. I definitely hope there is not going to be permission chains that are going to rule the world. But it's very, very important that you have a relevant number of open source permissionless institutional grade chains that people can build on.
Yeah. And I mean, clearly, you know, the traction shows that you guys are doing something right, I would say. And you also mentioned this just as a side note, that there were also some DTCC news today. So maybe you also want to elaborate a little bit more on that, because what you just, you know, what I at least briefly skimmed through sounded pretty massive. So maybe you can tell a little bit more about it.
Yeah, very, very happy to talk about that. So yes, this is the post-trade backbone of the US capital markets, if you want. It's similar for your audience in Europe, that's probably similar to Clearstream or Euroclear. Just at US scale, capital markets scale. So they are massive. So they have 114 trillion with a T in custodied assets, and they process a volume of 4.7 quadrillion in 2025. So they are the backbone of US financial markets. They have been working on tokenization and on-chain for a long time. They made a number of announcements in the last year, and they announced today that they're going to be making their tokenized assets available on the Stellar blockchain by the first half of next year, which is fantastic. We are the first public, open, permissionless blockchain in which DTCC has chosen to deploy. We are very honored that they're trusting on the Stellar blockchain, and we take that responsibility very, very seriously. And we hope and we expect that that's going to be one of the, also have a very large signaling effect with other institutions, both on the institutions that interact with DTCC, but also on the market infrastructure equivalents in places like Europe with the Euroclears and the Clearstreams, or places like Asia where market nodes, the relevant market infrastructure provider. These companies that are the most important companies that nobody has ever heard about, and that they are not household names, but they're really on the execution layer and the settlement layer of most of the capital markets activity. I think it's a fantastic win. Obviously, we take it as a fantastic win for us, and we're super happy that they have trusted the blockchain that we work on. But in general, beyond that, is a very important signaling in terms of open source permissionless architecture where everyone can build, that you can verify, that you can trace, that you can build your compliance structure on. So yeah, we're extremely excited about that.
Before we jump back into today's episode, a quick word about an event close to our hearts, the Point Zero Forum, an annual gathering of over 2,000 policymakers, central bankers, regulators, and industry leaders at the intersection of finance, technology, and policy. BFRR is proud media partner of the Point Zero Forum, and we'll be reporting live on site with the full co-host team. Organized by the Global Finance and Technology Network and the Swiss State Secretariat of Finance, the Point Zero Forum takes place in Zurich from 23rd to 25th June 2026. This year's lineup includes Swiss Federal Councillor Karin Keller-Sutter, Teva CEO Paolo Ardoino, former crypto head of policy at Andreessen Horowitz Brian Quintens, and NVIDIA's EMEA financial technology lead, Dr. Jochen Papenbrock. The agenda covers everything from AI in financial services and digital assets of stablecoins, tokenization, and the new regulatory frontier where the rules of finance are being rewritten. Come meet us in Zurich. Register at pointzeroforum.com, and as a BFRR listener, you get 30% off the full price industry pass with code BFRR2026. I repeat, BFRR2026.
Well, congratulations. I mean, it's fantastic. I think we have a title for the podcast now, Trillion with a T. No, seriously, well done. Let me ask one last quick question on institutions, and then we'll move on to another topic. But I think you have, Jose, such a unique insight here. So you, from your history with BBVA and then at PayPal, and what you were able to do at PayPal from as early as 2020 to move in that space, and now you know, folks like Maze Abinay leading the charge after the great work that's happening there. And if I look at the examples you give of these large institutions, or if I even see what MasterCard and Visa, it's a lot of really interesting innovation coming out of these big institutions. On the other hand, I have the scars, and you know this, we knew each other back then in the PayPal days. I have the scars to prove just how difficult it is to innovate in these large organizations. So just a couple minutes maybe on sort of your learnings and your insights on, you know, if I'm on the inside of one of these big institutions and I want to innovate in the digital asset space, how should I go about doing that? What would your advice be?
I think there are two or three things that probably translate to most institutions that I know. The first one is that you very clearly need a very senior executive support. So this is something that, especially in the last years where the regulatory clarity was less clear, there were risks involved in engaging in these activities. So it was very important to have a very strong support at the C level and the executive committee level of these institutions. I was lucky in my time at PayPal, it was the Digital Assets Institute was not only supported, but is very much a sponsor and driven by a CEO himself, Dan Schulman, who was extremely interested there. It was supportive. There was a strong support from the board, where Wences Casares was a big advocate of articulating the point of, hey, this can transform financial rails. It's too important for a company like PayPal not to have a role here. So you need a supportive board, you need a strong support from the CEO, you need support from the C-suite, because many of these companies are going to be functionally oriented, and it's really difficult to make it happen without touching into the office of the chief risk officer and the CTO and others. So any institution where you can attract to that line of support from, and you see that in the people who are leading the charge today, some institutions that we work with, a U.S. bank or DTCC themselves. So Frank LaSala, who's the CEO of DTCC, was at Consensus 3 weeks ago talking about their drive toward tokenization. So the first sign of success that I can tell anyone is how strong the support from the C-suite and the CEO themselves is. Then the other is that it takes a village. So, and Jonathan, you know the insights of PayPal, you know the insights of Meta. Nothing there, even if it is easy to attribute the work to a small group or to a person, nothing happens inside these institutions without the effort of hundreds of people. So being able to navigate that institution and build the right coalition and advocate is a skill in itself. And then there is a model that on how do you do it internally. Sometimes you're saying, hey, look, the institution moves too slow. We're going to build it as a speedboat on the side so that we can move faster. My point of view is that makes it easier to get from zero to one, but it makes it very difficult to get from one to 100 or 1,000, in the sense that you will build something, but then when there's the moment to integrate back into the core, you get into all types of social dynamics of not invented here, awkward square peg into round hole, and that's tricky. It's also true that if you build it purely separated, just another initiative in the core, it's very likely that it dies of 1,000 paper cuts. So you need to find the right equilibrium. On the PayPal days, we made a very concerted decision to build it inside the aircraft carrier and not as a speedboat, because then it might take you a little bit longer, but then the moment that you're pointing the aircraft carrier in the right direction, it's very difficult to stop. But we also built it in a way in which the crypto unit had end-to-end ownership of the thing. So the crypto team at PayPal was a dedicated product engineering, compliance, risk, finance, you name it, resources. Because this is very, very difficult. And it is, if you don't do it like that, then it's like the elephant and the people who are touching, say, an elephant is like a trunk or an elephant, it's like a column. You need someone who's, you need a team who's able to influence from product all the way to risk and regulatory. And the fourth leg, I would say, is probably external facing. Maybe it's easier these days than it was, but it's still not easy. And as you were saying, Jonathan, you had a front row seat to some of the impact on how you handle external stakeholders and the relevance of managing the regulatory and government relations piece of it inside one country and also across countries, because central banks and regulators and parliaments will care a lot about financial sovereignty. So you need to be able to articulate your narrative and explain why this is a net positive for the people involved.
Yeah, and this time more than ever, I would say. So I absolutely agree. And I think that is really what's really important what you said, like managing external stakeholders very well, really end-to-end ownership and C-level support. Like, I think this is really something else also that will stick with the audience, because most of our audience is also from the financial sector building all of that. So please, please listen to this carefully and apply this in your roles. And
our appeal on the powers that be. So one of the hottest topics, obviously, we have to touch on is AI, and specifically agentic payments, agentic commerce. And Jose, you said earlier, you're a payments guy, right? So love to get your view, obviously, how you think about it, but specifically, how does Stellar think about things like agentic payments?
We do think that this is something that will, and we've been preaching these for a long time. When people are asking about use cases for payments on stablecoins, we always tend to go to what can you do that is not easy to do in traditional payment instruments. And one of those is obviously things like micropayments. And sometimes people say, yes, but the app stores and pre-funding, and it's less of a problem. And I think that when you get to the moment of agentic commerce, that's when it gets really, really, really interesting for a number of reasons. One of them is it changes the interface of commerce. So you might not just be going to a website and clicking on a PayPal button or another PSP processing, getting your cards there. You might interact with that from an LLM, or you might interact with that from a different type of interface or even a different type of device. Also, it changes the amount and the speed of the payments, which means that it opens up things like streaming payments. It opens up machine-to-machine payments. It opens up how do you pay for watching a movie by the minute, or how do you pay for content creation and the creative economy in a way in which you can charge 50 cents to read a blog post from someone. Those sort of things that the credit card traditional networks are not set up to deal with. In terms of the settlement, but also in terms of the price and the minimums of those transactions make it prohibitively expensive. But that's purely in the transaction side. The other thing that happens is in payment networks, there is this obsession with TPS, right? Transactions per second, and what is the maximum load that you can use. And the common wisdom is, hey, you need to be able to sustain at least 1,000 transactions per second for a retail payments use case. Most of the companies that you will know and will operate around run rate, maybe 1,000 transactions per second. And in the big days, the Black Fridays, the holiday season, you need to be able to sustain peaks of 25,000 transactions per second. And that's probably the state of the art of what you can do. There are some numbers about what Alipay can do in very high environments. But I don't have any way to validate that. So let's say that the floor is 1,000, the peak is 25,000, and in the middle is where you operate in traditional payments. What I think is going to happen with agentic payments is that it is going to blow up those expectations in two aspects. On one side, and I think it was during Stripe sessions, the colleagues and brothers at Stripe were saying, hey, we need to have a structure that sustains 1 million transactions per second, or maybe 1 billion transactions per second. Well, 1 billion transactions per second might be slightly exaggerating, but I think that in the moment in which you have millions of agents that are interacting for very, very small size transactions, you could easily get to peaks of 1 million transactions. And not only that, it's not only the TPS on the network, it's the concurrency. So what happens with the payments API on a merchant side, if it gets hit at the same time by hundreds of thousands of agents hitting that API. I think that looks remarkably close to a denial of service attack in a way. So you need to make sure that as a merchant, you have infrastructure that is not going to make you die of success. And when this agentic commerce happens, that you can sustain that flood of transactions coming in. That's why I think that blockchains are so well suited for things like that. There are theoretical limits or theoretical estimates of maximum throughput in places like Stellar and others. But I'm seeing more and more projects that are working on massive parallelization of transactions to be able to sustain things like the highest I've seen so far is 750,000 transactions per second. Still in the lab.
Not too bad.
But I think that not too bad, not too shabby. And we were trying to figure out, and when I look at one of those projects, I'm thinking, 1 year ago, I would tell you, who needs this? And I would say, well, maybe market settlement, DTCC, Euroclear, maybe those folks need that volume of transactions. But who else? Well, it might be that every Tom, Dick, and Harry that is exposed to agentic commerce might need something like, at least to be able to peak at those levels. And last not least, in a world of agentic commerce, it's very difficult to give an agent access to your bank account and your credit card. For KYC, know your agent is definitely one thing that we'll be talking about in the future. In the contrast, it's relatively simple to give an agent a wallet with a stablecoin balance. Ask, hey, go your merry way, buy me this and buy me that. So I think that we will see agentic commerce, the practical implications for merchants and for the networks I'm going to see. You will see a ton of work in terms of protocols for agentic payments on chain. X402 is one example. MPP is an example. Probably you will see others. You will see the agentic merchant SDK. So what is the software development kit that the merchant will adopt to be able to ingest a payment request that are coming from X402, MPP, and whatever is going to be the next thing that happens. You will see work on know your agent. How do you do the attribution between identity of a human and identity of an agent? And then you see the payment instruments. I do think that you will see both fiat and on-chain instruments for agent payments. But it's a fascinating space.
For sure. And this identity piece is also something where we work a lot on at Datonic, because it's also here for, know your agent and payment authentication, pre-authentication. This will all be hot topics then for the topics that need to be solved for the agentic payments. We know time is running out very soon. So we really need to do a deep dive at a different session on AI. I have so many further questions, but at least we started addressing this high level. Maybe as a last question, Jose, before we wrap up, in this AI world, of course, also the topic of privacy, I have the feeling is getting, I wouldn't say getting lost, but less attention currently, right? Because with AI agents, a lot of people use it as a psychotherapist to share everything, right? But then vote for privacy. So yeah, what do you think, or also like, how do you at Stella deal with privacy enhancing technologies such as zero knowledge proofs? Because that's also stuff where we did some work at Datonic, which we think around AI, this can play an important role, but would love to understand, how are you thinking on the topic of privacy and these innovations before we round up?
Yeah, I think that if you're involved in payment use cases for blockchains, I think that privacy is paramount. Nobody's going to be adopting payments in a way in which for every merchant, all the payments are going to be public on an on-chain ledger. No, payroll is a very good use case. And when people start we actually see payroll as an emerging use case for stable coins, but people will not want to have the details of the remuneration being posted publicly. So there are a couple of ways in which people are going about it. We have strong opinions of what is the right one. Some folks are doing privacy first chains, and there is a long history of that at the infrastructure level. We don't think that that's the right approach. We think that the chain transactions should be public by default and private by configuration. And what I mean by that is it is important that the infrastructure continues to be public and visible on chain and traceable, because for many applications, you will not care or you will not have those hard requirements for privacy. And what we are building is that you can define and configure your privacy requirements at the application layer. So we are launching things like confidential tokens, so meaning implementations where the wallet addresses remain public, but the amount of transaction that is happening between the addresses is obfuscated and is not public on the chain. Or Stellar Private Payments, which is an implementation that our friends at Nethermind made on Stellar, which basically creates an association, meaning that we can define a group that is Jonas and Jose and Jonathan, and between us, there are going to be payments that are going to be transacted. Both the wallets and the transaction amounts are not public on chain, but you can still do it in a compliant way, in the sense that there are a set of view keys that if there is a request from the regulator or the actors who supervise payments, that you can provide visibility to those set to comply with that set of servers to comply with the regulation without just making available to everyone out there. That requires a bunch of infrastructure work that you have to do, which we think that's where the foundation should be spending most of the time. In our case, it has to do with things like enabling new elliptical curves that are a better fit than the traditional ones for privacy. Or as you were saying, you were talking about CK proofs, making sure that you can provide not only the elliptic curves, but also the hashing functions to enable that privacy, and then let developers and institutions build the privacy features that they want at the application level, but make sure that we are providing a base layer that is public by default and transparent by default, and then the tooling that so that you can configure your privacy requirements in a way that is compliant, but also in a way that is appropriate for your use case.
Jose, we could go on for hours in theory. I know we can't, though. Time's running out. So we'll close things out with this and hope we can get you back and actually go deeper on a lot of these topics. It was a fantastic conversation. We covered a lot of ground, from stablecoins to institutions, tokenized assets, AI. We covered it all, privacy, very importantly. Congratulations so much to you and the Stellar team on the DTCC win. I think it's a win for Stellar, but I think it's also a win for the industry when we can really literally talk about T, you know, trillions with a T. So that's, you know, well done to you. Thanks, everybody. And thanks to listeners for joining us today. For everyone listening, we will include links to Stellar, Jose's work, and some of the topics we discussed in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in to the Digital Money interview series on Bitcoin, fiat, and rock and roll. And we will see you next time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.